ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
यैत्रेह यथैवामुना नुना विहिंसिता जन्तवः परत्र यमयातनाम् उपगतं त एव रुरुवो भूत्वा तथा तमेव विहिंसन्ति तस्मात् मूरवम् इत्याहुर् इति सार्थात् अतिक्रूर सत्वस्यापदेशः। Translation: in this life, an envious person commits violent acts against many living entities. Therefore, after his death, when he is taken to hell by Yamaraj, those living entities who are hurt by him appear as animals called rurus to inflict very severe pain upon him. Learned scholars call this hell Rauru. Not generally seen in this world, the ruru is more envious than a snake. Purport: according to Sridhara Swami, the ruru is also known as the Bharashana. And then there's a quote which is from Sridhara Swami, presumably. Ati krurasya bharashingakhya sattvasya apadesha sangya. Srila Jiva Goswami confirms this in his Sandarbha. Ruru shabdasya swayam muninaiva tika vidhina lokeshva prasiddha evayam jantu visheshaha. Thus, although rurus are not seen in this world, their existence is confirmed in the shastras. First of all, as probably many visitors to New Dwaraka say in their classes, I'm very happy to be here in New Dwaraka Dham, where the presence of Srila Prabhupada is very strongly felt, especially if you don't come here every day. I mean, you tend to get used to it, isn't it? Familiarity breeds, in this case, not content, but familiarity, more familiarity. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada, of course, spent so much time here, so in that way, Srila Prabhupada's presence is felt, and also because the attempt to maintain the same mood as Srila Prabhupada inculcated, or what's the word? We need a new word. There's things which spiritual people do which material people don't do. So just by his presence, the spiritual atmosphere was always there in Srila Prabhupada's presence. So in this New Dwaraka Dham, the attempt has been and is to keep Prabhupada in the center by following his instructions and distributing his books, and therefore we feel Srila Prabhupada's presence here. Srila Prabhupada was once asked, I think Mukunda Datta Prabhu knows by who, is Bhagavad Gita spoken on the hellish planets? This was in London, this question was asked, so Prabhupada, he replied, I'm speaking here in London. So Mukunda Datta Prabhu told me that I'd be speaking on the hellish planets, and I told him, no, I'm speaking in New Dwaraka. So outside, it's Southern California. The Southern California branch of hell. And inside, it's the New Dwaraka branch of the spiritual world. Anyway, we're supposed to be speaking about hell here.
fire and brimstone.
Well, it's interesting that our Vaishnava Acharyas, they don't emphasize hell. It's hell, according to Vaishnava understanding, is not as serious as Christian or Islamic understanding, because you don't go there forever. You can come back. You won't go. I won't go there forever. Envious people go to hell. Yes. Horrible, isn't it? As Srila Prabhupada points out in one purport, people, they doubt the existence of hell. But even on this planet, hellish conditions are seen. Now, generally, we wouldn't think Southern California is hellish. And there are more hellish places. We see hellish species, we can see, in this world. And, much of Iraq and Afghanistan, the situation there is quite hellish, due to the present military situation. I'm not going to make any political comments here. Envious people are sent to hell, and there they're attacked by Rurus. This particular hell is called Rourav, from which appears to be derived from the word Ruru. Rurava becomes Rourava. Ruru is so envious, more envious than a snake. If we see the eyes of a snake, just the eyes are very envious. The eyes of a snake or a crocodile or a cat, for that matter. Just look, seeing the eye looks is extremely envious. You don't want to get too close to them. But once in a zoo, I happened to be in a zoo in Copenhagen for some reason. Oh, we went there to China. So I could come very close to the crocodile. An extremely envious look in his eye. Now, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada quotes Jiva Goswami that Rurus are not seen in this world, but their existence is confirmed in the Shastras. In other words, we have to accept what Shastra says, that we may not have seen a Ruru. It's not seen in the world, but they are in hell. There are such creatures in hell who are extremely envious. Envious means they like to give pain to others. The snake that is called cruel, because sometimes for no apparent reason they may bite someone. In Mayapur, I remember years ago, this was Santosh, our gardener. Now there must be so many gardeners. He told the story of, in the hut they lived in, his family. So a Bengali family means so many people, at least in those days. And some of his sister-in-law or someone, there'd be so many people sleeping, but in the morning they woke up and found her dead. The one woman who's sleeping right in one corner. There are so many lined up. And it was seen she was dead, and the marks of the punctures of the snake had been there. So she was bitten by a snake. So the snake, to reach her, he must have come in and gone past all the other people and bit her, and then come out again without anyone even knowing anything. So a snake is extremely cruel. Why exactly that happened, they didn't know. Jayapataka Maharaj told me years ago, this was I think one of the first, maybe the first flood in Mayapur, that one man had been in a tree above the flood level. He was waiting there for days to be rescued, several days, in the cold and rain. And he was on one branch, and on another branch just close to him, there was a cobra wrapped around the branch. So any time he knew the cobra could bite him. But the cobra didn't, so they coexisted for several days until a boat came and rescued that man. And just as he was getting down into that boat, having survived the flood and the cobra hadn't bitten him, so he thought he felt some kind of kinship with the cobra, having been there for several days, and just touched him to say goodbye. It was a stupid thing to do because the cobra bit him and killed him. So that's the no reason to. It's like out of friendship, he just, I guess, touched his tail or whatever, but he didn't live to tell the tale. Someone else told it for him. So, snakes we see, very cruel, because they, for apparently no reason, they give harm to others, they even kill others. So an envious person means, for no particular reason, they like to give pain to others. They take pleasure in giving pain to others. This is the lowest limit of consciousness, the lowest consciousness possible, to take pleasure in giving pain to others. This is the lower limit of the mode of ignorance. In the mode of ignorance, generally people are just not very conscious at all, but unnecessary anger, vritta hingsa, that's mentioned as one of the characteristics of Kali Yoga, meaningless violence. So people who, without any reason, just that they take pleasure in seeing the suffering of others, para dukkha sukhi, they're very happy to see others in distress. Such persons, they go to a hell where they get appropriate, reciprocal punishment. We'll see all these hells, they're described that according to what you do, you get that kind of punishment. So maybe people, they go from one hell to another to, if they're poly sinners or multiple sinners. Generally people, they don't just sin in one kind of way, they generally sin in various kinds of ways. So those who are envious, they are treated to a spell in a hell where a creature more envious than a snake gives them their requisite punishment. A creature more envious than a snake, because a human being can be more envious than a snake. Sarpat krurat, kala krurat. Sarpat krurat kala. Srila Prabhupada used to quote sometimes the Chanakya saying that a snake is cruel and a cruel man is cruel, but a cruel man is more cruel than a snake, because mantro shadhivashah sarpa, by mantras and application of some medicine or some kind of something like that, some chemically made goods, the snake can be taken under control. But kala kim, what is that? Kala kim na vikuryavat. The envious person, there's nothing you can do. You chant some mantras, and we see that. Sometimes the envious people, we chant and they're already envious, and they become more envious. It's very commonly seen. I don't know so much now, but certainly previously, when we go for our chanting, public chanting, that people, they become upset, very upset, just because we're chanting. Maybe because we're happy. Some people become very envious. Devotees are happy. They don't like to see others happy.
So the Ruru is who will punish the sinful people? Snake's not. Snake is just, you know, in probably the envious people, they'll eat up the snake. I was just in Rome, I heard a joke, a black joke, you could say, that the gladiators, well, not the gladiators, well, the Christians, they were thrown to the lions. And they said that, well, nowadays if you throw the Christians to the lions might be more afraid because the Christians are so expert in killing animals and eating them. So, who will punish the envious people? Then it has to be someone more cruel than a snake, more cruel than them. And here it said that those living entities who are hurt by the envious people, they take the role of, they become rurus. So it sounds like a very complex chain of karma. If someone is victimized by an envious person, then they get the chance to inflict more pain on that envious person by taking the position of they become extremely envious. So that's why it's extremely dangerous for someone who is mistreated by someone to think that I am mistreated, to bear a grudge and to desire to, what's the word? Give them reciprocal, requite their revenge. Yeah, this. If you think that, if I get the chance. Of course, we see the Pandavas; they had some motive like that, Bhima especially. But that's when we hear about the devotees who apparently have lower motives or mundane motives. We should not think that they do so in the same way that mundane materialistic people do. Just like Bhima, he was so angry. He had anger in his heart for 13 years. He was just dreaming of the day when he could drink Dushasana's blood. But we shouldn't think that this is some mundane envy. But rather, he's so angry. He's holding that anger that my queen, Draupadi, the great devotee of Krishna, she's been so insulted. These people, the sons of Dhritarashtra, have taken the role of rulers of the world, but they have so much misusing that position, setting such a bad example. In this way, it should be understood. Rurus, we don't see them. Lokeshva prasiddha. But they are understood to exist due to the very fact that they are mentioned or described in Shastra means that they exist. This is the point that Jiva Goswami makes in the comment that Srila Prabhupada gives. Srila Prabhupada, he always made the point that what I am saying, Srila Prabhupada would say, is on the basis of Shastra. We cannot speak beyond the basis of Shastra. In 1969, I believe it was, when the first men landed on the moon, Srila Prabhupada didn't believe any of it, even though it was shown live on TV, and Srila Prabhupada was watching it. He didn't believe it. And Purushottam, his servant at that time, didn't believe Srila Prabhupada. But you see, the whole world is celebrating the one small step for man and one great step for mankind, and Prabhupada's just laughing. This is all nonsense. And Purushottam went away. He became black-faced, more black than Jamuna when the ghee caught on fire and her whole sari and face became covered with soot. So, which happened at the same time. So, Purushottam, he went away, and Prabhupada's comment was that, I can understand he might not believe me, but how could he disbelieve Shastra? Srila Prabhupada was surprised that Purushottam would not believe Shastra. Of course, no one in the world believes Shastra, especially outside India. That's why sometimes, or outside the Hindu community, that's why they call it Hindu Shastra. It's considered a dogmatic or sectarian religious tracts. But Srila Prabhupada always presented Shastra as we understand it to be truth. Shastra is a record or transmission of that which is factual. So Srila Prabhupada was surprised that Purushottam could not believe Shastra. And we might be surprised that Srila Prabhupada was surprised, because Purushottam was, after all, just echoing the sentiments or the conviction of all of the rest of the world except Prabhupada. Although times have changed. But at that time, everyone thought they'd been to the moon. Pretty much everyone. Even the Chinese, I was told when I was living in Thailand for some time, I was told that the Chinese had stopped worshipping the moon. This is the Chinese in Thailand, because they thought it would become contaminated by the Americans going. But Prabhupada expected that at least his disciples, they've come so far, they've changed their lives and taken initiation. Srila Prabhupada didn't think that it's on the basis of what I said, but they've done so on the basis of what Shastra says. Prabhupada didn't come and say, well, I say this, 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 and that, and you should believe it. Srila Prabhupada never presented his message in that way. He always presented, this is in Shastra, therefore it should be accepted. And I should be accepted in as much as I am presenting Shastra. And this is the standard that Srila Prabhupada gave, and that distinguishes him from so many bogus gurus. And in India today, almost all of the gurus, or so-called gurus, they're all bogus, even though they may present a few lines here and there from Shastra, but they don't have any systematic approach to Shastra, system of checks and balances by which their message can be understood. They basically talk all nonsense, and sometimes some of them throw in a few words from Shastra here and there. But Srila Prabhupada's approach was quite different, that he presented himself as a channel or a medium of presenting reality, the truth, because he is presenting what is in Shastra, as is understood through the disciplic succession of perfect acharyas. And what is the perfection of the acharyas is that they speak Shastra, and they follow what is in Shastra. And Shastra is the center. We say Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, but Shastra is the center. Guru or sadhu means one who speaks what is in Shastra. Guru is a guru because he speaks the truth that is in Shastra, and not as is commonly and disastrously misunderstood, that because a guru is a guru, therefore whatever he speaks is the truth. There's a lot of difference. That it's not that anyone can just say whatever they like, and he has a rubber stamp on his head called guru, or he's self-appointed or appointed by someone as guru, and therefore whatever he says must be true. But rather, because whatever he says is true, therefore he's a Shastra. He's guru, and we can know what he says is true because it's there in Shastra, and therefore he quotes Shastra. Now, interestingly, how to understand Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, because apparently there are contradictions. Well, the gurus come to resolve doubts that we may have. apparent contradictions. How we can understand the contradictions. Shastra yuktye sunipun drida shraddhaja utamadikari she tareye shamsar. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu described an uttamadhikari as one who shastra yuktye sunipun. So Srila Prabhupada, he translated this as one who is expert in presenting arguments on the basis of shastra. Another meaning of shastra, yukti. Yukti is a word like related to yoga. So it means one who can, also shastra yukti sunipun means, can also mean one who is very expert in harmonizing the statements of shastra that may appear to be disharmonious. He's a harmonist. The English magazine of the Gaudiya Math in the days of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was called the harmonist. The harmonist, the topmost devotee who can show the harmony in the statements of shastra, even though two persons who are disharmonious with Krishna, the statements in shastra may appear to be disharmonious. So shastra juktye shunipun drira shabhaja, and who has firm faith, is an uttamadhikari who can deliver the whole world. Now, therefore we need sadhus to describe or present shastra to us. The shastra was presented by Vedvyas, by various rishis, among whom Vedvyas is the ultimate rishi, we can say. Chakara Bhagavan Rishi, it's stated about Vedvyas Rishi, he made or compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam. He's described as a Rishi. Also in the second verse of Bhagavatam, he's described as a Rishi, one who reveals the scripture. So, Vedvyas presents Shastra, but Shastra is never meant to be a do-it-yourself. Teach yourself the truth in 30 days. Become self-realized in 30 days. Do-it-yourself book. It's never meant to be do-it-yourself. Shastra is meant for being taught. Of course, there's also swadhyay. There is also self-study. That's part of Shastric study. But that's too... Traditionally, that's meant to complement the... teachings which are heard, the shastra is to be heard and explained by the gurus who, just like Krishna, the guru spoke to Arjuna, and apparently Krishna went over the same subject again and again. Many of the topics Krishna repeats in somewhat slightly different angles, different ways, until his disciple Arjuna has got it. Again and again, Krishna has to go over the different points. What is, even at the beginning of the 18th chapter, Arjuna is still asking this, more or less the same question he's been asking all the way through, that, well what is the difference between this tyaga, renunciation, and sannyas? So Arjuna is still... the whole point, which you just couldn't seem to get at the beginning of the, that how can one be renounced and work in the world? So Krishna, he takes that from various angles, discusses this in various ways as other points. In the beginning, he establishes how the soul is different from the body. Then again, throughout Bhagavad Gita, he discusses this in various ways, giving more detail about how this is so. And various other points, such as Krishna's own superiority, how he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna reiterates this throughout Bhagavad Gita. So it's not, the Shastra is not presented in what we might in the modern age consider to be a very systematic manner. It's not like a point A, point B, point C. It flows, and different points are taken up and then dropped and then discussed again in another context. There's a reason, one of the reasons for that is because the Shastra was never meant to be like this, do it yourself, teach yourself. It was always meant to be explained in this ways, and various teachers of Shastra, who are known as gurus, they teach their disciples according to the ability of the disciples to understand, according to the they may emphasize more certain points or in certain perspectives because different disciples, and especially in different times, places and circumstances, have differing prominent misconceptions. That's why we'll find that Srila Prabhupada took up the misconception of, he spoke a lot on the misconception that life has arisen from matter, which is nothing new about this idea. It's not that Charles Darwin and company invented all of this. But Srila Prabhupada particularly took up that point because that misconception was particularly strong in the world and among his disciples. They'd been, they or we had been drilled in this or raised in a culture in which that was accepted as if it is a fact. So like this, different gurus take up different points, different acharyas take up different points, different misconceptions. Actually, they're all more or less the same misconceptions, but they get draped in different dresses throughout the ages or presented in slightly different ways. So, Shastra is to be understood through the gurus. This point I wanted to make. That Jiva Goswami, Srila Prabhupada quotes here, that we have to accept the existence of gurus because they're mentioned in Shastra. And Shastra here states that gurus are animals of hell. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in one of, was that the Dinajpur speech? I didn't check it. That he said in one speech that, or in some writings, now in recorded in writing, that the descriptions of, yeah, it must be in that speech he gave about the Bhagavat, that was his, Notes on Bhagavat. I don't think it was titled, because we see different titles for that lecture. It's published. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was publicly coming out of the closet as his first declaration that now I am a Vaishnava, which was quite surprising because no one of his status at that time was. Modern, at that time modern, English educated, Bengali, and he was, British and then the Hindus themselves and the Brahmos, they had the Brahma Samaj, they considered Vaishnava Dharma to be the pits, that this is the whole, Brahma Samaj, of which Bhaktivinoda Thakur was somewhat partial toward at one stage, apparently. One of the main reasons that people left the Hindu fold to become Brahmas was because of the Vaishnav religion, as it was known at that time in Bengal. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur came out as a supporter of the Bhagavat, Srimad Bhagavatam, and therein he stated that the descriptions of hell as given in the Bhagavad, he said they're not real actually. So how do we understand this? And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says they're not real. And of course there are many things that Bhaktivinoda Thakur stated, especially in, it seems in his earlier writings, Sri Krishna Sanghita, which is much misquoted and misused by members of ISKCON since it's been published. what's considered the definitive book on Bhaktivinoda Thakur, this Hinduism's encounter with modernity by our, well, he was initiated by Prabhupada, so, Shukavak, but he's not speaking as Shuka should speak because he has a, non-parampara or understanding of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote in this way, it appears in a time when the Bhagavat was considered, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in the opening words to that speech, the Bhagavat is considered by various people in various ways, but in none of them very highly, except among the low class people who like to read it. It's considered this Vivekananda, Srila Prabhupada quoted, called Vaishnavism a sex religion. So it was considered, the Bhagavad was considered a treatise that promoted immorality in the name of religion. And it was mostly low class and foolish and not uneducated people. In that time in Bengal, there were two classes of educated people. Traditionally educated, that means in Sanskrit, and they'd mostly be smartas, smarta Brahmanas, and the modern English educated. So neither of them had a high opinion of the Bhagavad. And it was mostly, and they were also educated in Sanskrit, there were the Goswami class, but they were mostly, at that time education was going down among the Goswami class also, the professional, the caste gurus, Vaishnava gurus. So, they collected disciples, so they had, hereditary families of disciples, and they were just used to taking dakshina from the disciples, and they would, maybe some of them would recite Bhagavat, but the scholarship, Vaishnav scholarship, was at a low ebb. So it's understood that Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, yeah, how are we to understand this, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that the descriptions of the Bhagavat concerning hell, they're not actually true. How are we to understand that when Srila Prabhupada said, he very much emphasized that Shastra is not to be understood allegorically, but literally, except in passages which are clearly allegorical. So how are we to understand this? Is it Prabhupada is saying one thing, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying something different? Yeah, in this case they are saying something different, but it has to be understood very carefully that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he spoke, or he, in that way, for a certain purpose, to bring people to respect the Bhagavad. In the Sri Krishna Sanghita, he gave a whole chronology of the universe. He harmonized these the statements of Srimad Bhagavatam with the chronology of the universe as it was accepted at that time among mundane scholars, which today even among mundane scholars doesn't fit, because the mundane scholars have, surprise, surprise, changed their understanding of the history of the universe. So clearly Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he presented that just to get people to respect the Srimad Bhagavatam and start to hear it. So in this way we have to understand. Rurus, do they exist? Well, we will accept. Anyone else outside in the local branch of hell, they don't see rurus here. They see envious people. But they don't see rurus. They didn't see them yet. So, How are we to accept? How are we to get people to accept that? Well, we won't be able to make any scientific inquiry or find a, make a, get a stuffed ruru and put it in the museum. We're not likely to be able to do that. But Srila Prabhupada, he was very straightforward in his presentation. That people should accept this because it's stated in Shastra. So that's a great challenge for our movement to present this in a world which is full of quasi, what's called scientific, we could more accurately state to be quasi-scientific supposed realism, which a lot of the people in the world today have lost faith in anyway. We have that on one hand, and then on the other hand, we have rampant imagination or speculation, because people who come to spiritual life, or what they consider to be spiritual life, they think, well, because it's not bound by empiricism or even rationalism, therefore spiritual life is more or less whatever you imagine it to be, and it's just based on some vague sensations. And someone who's advanced spiritually, they may say something and, well, you just believe it. Or someone makes you feel good and that's spiritual. Or drugs are spiritual. They still say that in the hippie generation. That was, drugs were considered spiritual because they give you, spiritual means to come to a state of consciousness different to that or better than that which we normally perceive. So, well, drugs do that. on the one hand, we have cold, hard materialism, which just very unscientifically accepts as reality that which can be perceived within the extremely limited range of perception that our senses have. And whatever we can discover through our senses about the universe, the past, the future, they very unscientifically state this to be knowledge. Etaj gyanam iti proktam, agyanam yad agyanam yad anyonyata. What is that? Anything else, anyata. Anything else which is not within the scope of our senses, that is not knowledge, within the scope of our imagination. So on the one hand you have this very cold, hard materialism. On the other hand you have this just rampant speculation in the name of spiritual life. But Srila Prabhupada's presentation, or the presentation of any genuine spiritual scientist, is that there is truth, there is reality. It's reality is not liquid. It doesn't just change and take any form that you want it to be. As it's not dependent upon us what we think. Just like people say, "Well, I'm searching for the truth within me." Like, it's within me. Why within you? What's so great about you, this whole thing? Find the truth within. Why within? Who are you? You're so great that you're carrying the truth. And if you have the truth within you, then how come you don't know? Because you're greater than the truth, or what's going on? So the truth means whatever I perceive it to be. Extremely egoistic so-called spiritualism, or just based on some feelings or emotions. But Srila Prabhupada always presented Krishna consciousness as scientific. There is the truth, and there is a method to understand. There is a methodology, but you have to follow the methodology. There is scientific exposition of truth is given in Shastra, but we have to follow the methodology to access that. Just like you can show some book and throw it at someone, some book on calculus. Who knows how to do calculus here? Anyone? Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Fewer, yeah. So, for anyone else, if you just give them a book and say, here's the book on calculus, work it out. Well, you're not going to be able to do it. But if you, the book is there, you have to be trained also and on how to, or medicine. Someone say, you can put up a sign, cheap heart surgery, bypass surgery, only $100. Well, what's your qualification? Well, I read a book, now I'm ready to go. So, who will accept it? You have to be trained. So in the same way, Shastra is the method to access reality. But training is required also. So, I was told I could speak unlimitedly and I've already gone. There's no temple authorities here. Ah! What is it called? Buck the authority. But we have the authority of Shastra. This is the whole point. Srila Prabhupada. Sorry?
The stomach authority is always there.
The stomach authority is always there. That's a very good point when you're talking when you're talking with Mayavadis. They say this world is false, but when it's time to eat then they don't say it's false. I have a false feeling of hunger in my stomach, therefore I'm going to falsely go to the kitchen and falsely open the fridge and falsely open my mouth and falsely put something in. No. They're on the stage of annamai. They can see reality only as food. So if you say everything's false, well, you're feeling hungry, that's also false. So why spend some of your false money on food when you could just eat stew? It's all false. It's all false, right? So, what does it matter whether it's false bread or false stool? In fact, you could have recycling. So, anyway, that's another discussion altogether. All right. Hellish. You go to hell and eat stool. It's one of the stool, one of the hells. We're not going there. We're not going to go there, but others may do. So, any point, please? Yes? This should be spoken in the mic, is it? So that the others can hear, including the average 70 listeners on the internet broadcast. They're mostly LA devotees, is it? On the average? From all over, is it? Okay.
So we understand Shastra through the Guru, but it seems that we also understand Guru through the Shastra.
Yes, we also understand Guru through the Shastra. So which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Well, what comes first is Krishna. Ramanda Brahmite Kono Bhagavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Beach. Krishna inspires those who are sincere to approach a guru. And those who are not sincere, they may approach a guru who's not really a guru. And they get cheated. So Krishna inspires those who are sincere not to be shallow in their search for the truth. So that when one approaches a spiritual teacher, or one who presents themselves as a spiritual teacher, one should ask, what is your authority? Why should I accept you? So many people say so many things, why should I accept you? And they will say, well, this is on the basis, I'm not speaking what I say, but it's on the basis of Shastra. And that, and they can show you what is in Shastra. And of course, some, when we say no blind faith, but at some point in any philosophical discussion, if there's going to be any discussion whatsoever, there has to be some faith at some level. without accepting certain axioms, we can't have a discussion with anyone about anything. So, if we accept that, well, this world is ordered, it appears to have a purpose, as Srila Prabhupada presented this in the, when the Mike Robinson of the London Broadcasting Corporation asked Prabhupada about the Shastra, Prabhupada said, it's just like the microphone. The manufacturer of the microphone gives a manual by which you can understand what is the purpose of the microphone and how to use it. So with the creation, with the material world, comes the manual. That's called Shastra. So if we can, to a certain extent, we have to use our own intelligence to understand that there should be a controller, this world should have a purpose, and the fact that we are searching for that means we should be able to find it. And the manufacturer of the universe makes some provision by which we can understand, and that is Shastra. So Shastra describes, and there should be some experts also who can explain that. So Krishna gives both the Shastra and the Guru, and we have to use our intelligence to access that. In this second canto, Srila Prabhupada, there's that long purport in which he talks about how we can ascertain the presence of the Super Soul. And he goes, I was just speaking yesterday with Hari Vilas Prabhu about that. He said this to me, that there are seven stages, of which six do not rely on Shastra at all. It's just human intelligence by which we can answer. So which comes first, Guru or Shastra? Krishna comes first. Krishna gives them both. And if we are, he gives the Shastra by which we can understand him, and he gives the Guru by which we can understand the Shastra. And if we're sincere, then Krishna will guide us to a guru who can explain the Shastra to us. So, like I say, there has to be some sincerity also to accept that. For instance, if we want to accept as a guru someone who just says whatever he likes, well, then that's our foolishness. And there'll be initial faith, but that will become more, that will become solidified. That's why we have, that will gradually become solidified. That's why Shastra says that we shouldn't accept a guru immediately. We should wait for a year before formally accepting initiation. That means that we do accept to some extent, or we wouldn't, otherwise we wouldn't go on hearing. If we thought there's nothing here for me, then we wouldn't go on hearing for a year. We'd just move on somewhere else. So there's, one is, enjoined to hear and go on hearing and to maintain some reservations for some time until one is convinced that the message of Shastra is being presented and I'm understanding, my understanding of reality is increasing, that this, it should appeal to our intelligence also. So who is the arbitrator? Ultimately the disciple in himself is the arbitrator of this. But there comes a point when he has to surrender, and then he has to accept. That doesn't mean he accepts blindly. This is a big topic. As Arjuna didn't, he accepted Krishna, shishyastehaṁ śādibhaṁ tvaṁ prapannam. But at the same time, he didn't necessarily accept everything that Krishna said without, he wanted further explanation several times. Means he was ready, oh okay Krishna, I accept what you say is true, but katame tadvijaneyan tamado proktavaniti. How can I understand, he says, Arjuna to Krishna, that you spoke this previously to Vivasvan? Doesn't seem to make any sense at all. But then Krishna explained, Arjuna said, how can I understand? He didn't say, come on, we are talking a bunch of rubbish, how could you speak to Vivasvan? He didn't say that. He said, how can I understand it? It's something, I don't understand what's going on here, please explain it. Yeah.
Just one brief point on that subject.
Yeah, please wait for the mic to come. all of these points should be studied carefully and presented systematically for the benefit of people of the modern age who like things presented systematically. We see Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who I was speaking about, he took the message of Shastra, and especially, well, in several books, but especially Chaitanya Shikamrita, he presented very systematically the teachings of Shastra, how it can be understood. Yes, please.
It's a good thing that Mahatma brought up this subject, because it seems that even highly advanced personalities can be fooled at this point. Look at the situation at Dhammeshwar Island. Those great sages that assembled there, they had appointed Lord Maharshi Vasudha as the leader to hear from him. He had all the qualifications, the connection to Parampara was there, the knowledge was there, everything apparently was perfect. Was
direct right. Disciple of Vyas, yes, Rama Maharshi and Sutta.
And Lord Balaram came and shattered an illusion that his heart had not changed, in spite of the fact that he had all this knowledge and he had the right connection. So we have to go beyond just the connection to Shastra. Yes, the guru has to know Shastra, but everybody actually not the devotees who know Shastra. That's why we're drawn not to associate with my because they know Shastra better than us back in that. They can quote Vedas coming, you know, out of their pores. But the heart is not changed. The heart is actually hard against the personality of God. So there has to be the character test also. The character has to be there. The genuine connection to Krishna.
And it may be difficult to ascertain the character, as in the case of Rama Maharshi and Sutta, who he went through all the motions of doing everything right, but actually he was envious of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yeah. Thank you for that comment.
Yeah, following up on this idea that systematic study is appealing to this day and age, you seem to indicate that there's some danger in that process and that it tends to create in one of the assumption that we can conquer knowledge rather than receive knowledge.
Oh, I'll just interrupt briefly. The Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami they systematically present the thesis of Bhagavatam. Yeah, please continue.
Yeah, so, and generally it's not only Srila Prabhupada, but pretty much anyone of any traditional mode of pedagogy or instruction is, you know, in South Asia at least, it tends to be not systematic. And so I'm wondering if that's deliberate, and if so, how can we present things in a way that's appealing to the modern mind and systematic method without falling to that tendency to think that we can really control the process.
I'm supposed to give a systematic answer to that. Srila Prabhupada was very expert in giving, often he gave replies to questions which, or in an almost mystical way, he would reply in such a manner that the question was answered without directly answering it. And I can't think of anything just off the top of my head, although there must be hundreds of examples of that. To say what is required to destroy someone's illusion is maybe a gift from Krishna, and it can't be systematic. It's just like on book distribution, exactly what to say to someone so they'll take a book. There's any standard, any experienced book distributor will say there's no lines or formula. You have to chant your rounds and go out and pray. And then Krishna tells you what to do. You don't know what it's going to be. I think any preacher also, apart from book distribution or dealing with people individually, we have experience where sometimes we just say the right thing or do the right thing. It might even just be a glance at someone, or it just does the trick. I once in Bangalore, after a class, someone said to me that I've been chanting 16 rounds for 12 years, but I just can't give up garlic or onions. I've asked so many people, and I just can't give it up. And, you know, what's your suggestion to me? I said to them, 12 years you've been chanting and you couldn't give up garlic or onions? I'm not going to waste my time talking to you. And I just walked away. And that did it for them. That's what did it, somehow or other. So you don't know. But it's very difficult to say, because, I mean, even Srila Prabhupada, sometimes, we can't say that what he said was the wrong thing, but sometimes the person just wouldn't accept it. Many times, actually. And they would think Prabhupada was wrong, or they would remain confused, or it was difficult for them to accept it. The proper attitude on the part of the disciples should be that whatever my guru does is perfect. But some, especially in the modern age, it seems that the guru almost has, it's like playing some game of phantom boxing or something with the disciple. It's like, you know, have to think about their feelings, because in the modern age everyone's talking about feelings, you have to be sensitive and all this kind of, all this new age stuff, you know. And it's not like the guru says something and then the disciple, they just do what the guru says. Now why don't you train your disciple? You know, the disciple just kind of calculates and thinks. And you know, it's like a kind of give and take, like there's like tug of war or something like that. So how to deal in situation? Is it Prabhupada, he said that Ravi Shankar was shocked, and not this present Sri Sri rascal, but the sitar player. He came to the West. He was shocked that people were sitting with their feet pointing to him, and they're supposed to learn from him how to play sitar. Whereas in India, many of the musicians, who especially the tabla players, they're Muslims, and they follow all the culture. Otherwise, you can't play classical music at all. They'll do the, you know, the prayers to Sarasvati and everything. They know all this, but you come to the West and you get these people there. They want to learn, but they have no culture of learning whatsoever. And they'll lie down on the floor like this when they're supposed to be learning something. There's no culture whatsoever. So how Prabhupada was able to teach that to such barbarians as Jayam Vishnupada, ourselves nowadays. That's a gift from Krishna, isn't it? The systematic is there also. We see the Shat Chandarbha, the systematic presentation. But again, that is meant to be taught, isn't it? And I wonder how many in the history of Gauriya Vaishnavism have actually learned the Shat Chandarbha. So it's quite a job to go through all of that. I think it may not have been many, a small percentage of Gauriyas would have actually studied that from their gurus, but it's really essential, actually. Yeah, okay, we really are running over time. I don't mind, I'm free. But yeah.
Yeah, at some point the question from Manhattan, Srila Prabhupada said one time, don't trust me, trust Krishna out of humility.
That's don't trust me, don't trust Krishna, Prabhupada said. That is actually a theological statement. It's not a joke. It's a theological statement. We trust Prabhupada because he, again, the same point, he speaks what Krishna spoke. It's a theological statement.
Now my question. At the beginning of your talk, you were mentioning that since the verse is talking about enviousness and different animals and snakes and gurus, and I was surprised that, you know, when you mentioned the cat, it's envious too.
Well, that's a subjective, look at the eye of a cat and you'll see it looks like the eye of a snake or a crocodile.
So since
cats are often, anyway, in the horror movies and this and that, there's the cats. The cats are there. And listen to them at night. I mean, you don't have to listen, you'll hear them.
So the question was that since the scriptures recommend not to associate with atheistic, the more, you know, enemies people, would the people who shelter or adopt cats in their homes?
Dogs or cats? People have dogs and cats in their homes. Well, according to Shastra, people keep dogs in their homes. Only Chandalas keep dogs in their homes. Although recently in ISKCON, Ljubljana, in Slovenia, in the gift shop, I saw vegetarian dog food and vegetarian cat food. And I laughed for about 5 minutes. I think they removed it after that, but they're going to have to suffer me repeating that again and again, because Even in these days, I thought I was beyond being shocked, but even I was surprised. I mean, devotees do keep dogs and cats, but you know how to encourage it. Yeah, if you're keeping dogs in the house is for chandalas. We see, who is that? This Rantidev. Chandala came to him with dogs, saying, "We're all very thirsty. This, give us the water which you have to drink." So, chandalas keep dogs. You keep Takoji in your house and Fido also. No, it's an offense to keep a dog in a house if you have deities. Yeah.
Sometimes Vaishnava charges, they say that please let me be your dog. They don't say please let me be your cat.
That's an interesting, yeah. That's interesting. A cat is always independent. You know, some may say this is my cat, but the cat never thinks that they belong to you. Their attitude is quite different to that of the dog, isn't it? The dog is... that's one good quality of the dog. One Srila Prabhupada, he was talking about the dogs barking at night in Vrindavan, and Prabhupada said they're just a condemned species. There's no use in having any sympathy for them. They're just meant to suffer. But then he said, well, they have one good quality, is that they're very faithful to their master. You going to say something?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, pass over the mic.
Hare Krishna. I very long ago once, but from my faint memory, I remember that on the notes on Bhagavata Bhaktivinoda Thakur.
Which song did you say?
In the notes on Bhagavata, the article. At one point, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he states like there are descriptions of hell in scriptures which are not true. And I guess at some point later in the same article, he says that, but the description in Bhagavata of the hell, they are not of the same kind as those in the other scriptures. So he makes like two different...
He makes
a distinction. First he says that descriptions of hell, in some scriptures, they are not true. They are just meant to keep people in control of. Later stage, I think he mentions that. But the description in Bhagavata of the hellish planets are not of the same kind.
Is it? Alright, so maybe you got it. I'll have to have a look and see.
Yeah.